This episode of the Deck Tees Podcast is brought to you by Gathering Magic and CoolStuffInc.com. Become a part of their customer rewards program when you make any purchase and receive discounts on all future orders. That is CoolStuffInc.com. Episode 117 of the Deck Tees Podcast. I am your host, Erin Campbell. New Year's Eve and the holidays are a difficult time to try to find people to record with because they're celebrating with their loved ones or they're recovering from their holidays, and I wasn't sure what I was going to do, so I decided that I would bring one of my very dear friends on the show and we would talk about some very big moments from 2014 and what we would like to have happen in 2015. Welcome back to the show, Adrienne Reynolds. Hello.
Hi, Erin. How are you?
I am good. How about yourself?
I don't know. Actually, I'm thinking about it. It's a little weird to be talking to you without, like, a project to promote. Because we talk a lot.
Well, what, we need a reason to talk?
We talk a lot. But yeah, like, now it's just kind of like magic gossip.
But this is kind of fun. You know, I, like I said, I've spent the most of the year having these very structured interviews and having to do a lot of research. And, you know, I like having shows where I can just sort of kick back and just talk to my friends and turn it into something that people might want to hear about. Like if I do my spoiler shows, you know, those are fun. And it's great to sort of, you know, defragment or deprogram a little bit?
De-stress.
So this is just what the doctor
ordered. Yeah, both,
so
both of us should go get a hair relaxer and let our hair de-stress.
Man, that reminds me, I was watching, I signed up for Hulu Plus the other day, and they have RuPaul's Drag Race on there, and there's a drag queen on there named Jinx Monsoon, and one of the judges had tried to critique her about how dry her hair was, and she made it, and her response to that was, I tried to tease it, but I just pissed it off. And I was like, I've been there many times.
Over the summer, one of the site locations that I was at while I was doing the ethnography, so my hair, for people who don't know, my hair is like really crazy. It can be very curly and out of control, or it can just be very wavy and out of control. And if I braid it down and sleep in it, it could look like somebody tried to straighten it but failed. But what it always is kind of significant in size. So I was staying in a home, an informant's home, with two youngish children, and I had come out of the shower, and the little boy was like just pointing at my hair and laughing because with no product in it, it's super curly, but it's also wet. So he was just laughing because it looked funny because he didn't think it could get that small.
Yeah, it's definitely deceptive. I know I just picked up some hair gel and it's like level 10 ultra hold wet look. And I, you know, when I put that in, I'm like, oh, this is, I could just look like this all of the time, and then the gel wears off, and then poof, the hair just poofs out again. And,
I think we should have an anti-Gorgon card that's like a blue or a white control card that's actually just hair tamer.
You know, put that in the next unboxing set. You know, Jason.
Well,
Alt,
that would be
Jason
awesome.
Alt's trying
hair
to...
products for Gorgons. Some of them puff them up and buff them, and some of them are, but they're all sorceries because we all know for Gorgons and for us, there is no solution that's a permanent.
It's funny because I've heard there are petitions going around where they're trying to get another unhinged set or another unglued set released. And, you know, what a perfect idea.
Yeah. And we can give it out for free. Nobody has to credit us. Nobody has to pay us. We release it to the internet. Maybe the Blues Cube will pick it up.
There we go. We have to, I don't know, we have to add a magic twist. Maybe call it like Phyrexian pomade or
well,
something.
Well, are there Gorgons in Phyrexia?
No.
So, but you can have Theros pomade.
There we go.
And also, like, that's a place where all the curly hair is.
That you're right.
Yeah,
you're
I mean, how nice was it at the beginning of the year to be in Theros? Like, how did you feel about that block?
You know, I was actually pretty happy about it. I was surprised. Well, maybe I shouldn't say surprised because I did expect it a little bit. But it was interesting seeing the reaction from people that there were no blonde hair, blue eyes, you know, typical standard of beauty people like we're used to seeing. It was, you know, dark-haired folks and tan folks.
And very
multi-variations of that.
Which was true for the era.
Yeah, and even different body types I saw, and Nylea being referred to as a god and not a goddess, and that being done, and yeah, I was pretty happy with that. And most of the people and the discussion that came out from Ashiok existing was awesome. So that whole block I think got people talking in a really good way.
And it was pretty to play in, but I started running. Well, I mean, so of course this year is the year that I launched the ethnography, but at the time that the new year had started, that wasn't even on my radar. Like, that wasn't a thing that I was going to do. So I was still at the, oh my gosh, I'm at Bryn Mawr, I'm never going to get to play Magic again stage. Which was sadly entirely too true. So like all I was doing was pre-releases, but the art was so pretty. And I did play like one or two sealed things when I could. But we went into the new year from 2014. We went when everybody realized the joy that is pack rat that I had been advocating when everybody thought it was only for limited.
And see, my perception of Theros was colored by the fact that I didn't like Theros Limited. Theros Limited was very much what we refer to as Voltron magic, where you take one creature, you stack it with auras, and then you throw it at somebody. And because the removal was so expensive or was so conditional, you likely didn't have a way to deal with it unless you caught it early in the Voltron process, or you had your own big Voltron that you could throw in front of it. And I just don't like that. I don't like that style of limited. I like the basic limited where you got your curve, you got your twos, you got your threes, you got your fours, you got your 17 land, and you need at least 10 creatures. Just the basic rules of limited, and Theros Limited just completely screwed me up. I didn't like it, I didn't do well with it, I didn't adjust to it. I was very happy when that was over.
I was actually really happy that when the new year came and the Journey to Nyx release, well, that wasn't Journey to Nyx, it's Theros, it's Born of
Born
the
of the
Gods,
Gods?
and then Journey to Nyx. So when the Born of the Gods release came out, I was so sick of three color decks from 2013 and the compulsive sticking with names no matter what, which is always a pet peeve. But like I really liked that mono black was a thing, but there was also mono blue. Like I liked Devotion rewarding a more narrowed mana base. And then one of the reasons that I don't actually remember Born of the Gods is Born of the Gods is when I did that thing that changed my entire life, which is I needed to do a field study prototype in a week's notice. And they were like, go sit in a subway and watch people walk back and forth and observe them and take field study notes or go to a bar or sit on a bus. And I'm like, I'm old and I was an actor. And as a project manager, I did needs assessment. And like doing any of these things is not going to teach me anthropology. I'm going to do exactly what I did in those other things. And it's going to be fine for you. And I'll know that I have not done it. So I worked it out that the only thing that I could do on that short notice was be at the pre-release for Born of the Gods to do this observation, which is like a 6-hour observation. And I realized, like, I had never observed one. I'd never observed one. I'd always been playing.
Observed a pre-release? Okay, so you didn't play at all, you just
Which I had
watched.
never done before. And
Wow.
actually, because it's participant observation, and remember that this was undergrad and it was a project, it was like our midterm project that I was doing, you're supposed to be a participant observer. And so I was scheduled to play Two-Headed Giant. Our store does one two-headed giant in the middle of Saturday. And the
We
way
do
I
that
keep
too.
my budget going is I play every pre-release that I can possibly play, and that's where I get my first set of cards, and then I buy a box. And that's how I move through. Then I just pick up cards as I need them or as I'm playing sealed. So I was signed up for the two-headed giant. My partner for two-headed giant couldn't come out, and rather than re-up with someone else, which is what I usually do, I sat it out entirely. And I also did participant observation for the single play afterwards. So I had both and I wrote it up. And obviously my professor liked it very much and said, you should do an ethnography of MTG. And I laughed at that professor maniacally, going, do you have any idea what you're asking right there? But it ended up that she was right, and that launched this whole thing for reasons that people can go back to the other podcast to find out. But what I found out was, if I don't play that pre-release, I have like no tactile sense of the cards. Like playing one pre-release event is not enough for me to like have the feel of play or even the cards stick in my memory.
I would even argue, or not even argue, but I would even add that playing in those events might even still not be enough because you're seeing them in a vacuum. You're seeing them at a pre-release sense. You know, my pre-releases tend to be very casual. So people are, you know, turning off their inner spike. They are building more fun things. They're not really in it to win it. And you're seeing the cards in a limited vacuum. So cards that might be very good at your pre-release, you still might not know how good they're going to be in standard or modern.
Yeah, or
EDH
even casual. If you're not playing pickup games, pre-releases by themselves are their own culture, and there are, I have discovered, people who just come to play pre-releases.
That's actually their
connection to Magic. They go, they collect their cards, and the way they play is pre-releases, which is awesome.
Yeah, we have people. We have a lot of people at my store that do that, and I've also noticed there are a lot of couples that will come out just for the two-headed giant portion.
We have ringers that are two-headed giant participants. Mm-hmm. I know, because I lose to them every time. And I really don't know how they do it, but apparently, like, two-headed giant used to be a very serious tournament format at some point that I'm not aware of. And they were, like, the tops at this, and they just come in, and we're so super casual that, like, and they're very sweet, which is nice, but, you know, you sit down against them, and you're like, you can tell if you've got a shot by the second round when you play them, if you know who they are. Like if their first three rounds are like total synergy and total interconnected, you're just like, there's no way we even know these cards enough to beat you this fast unless we just race you.
You can also tell by their dynamics, where it's like, you know, going back to the couples thing, and I find the couples to be so fascinating because, and Hallie and I talked about this, I think, on a previous episode where we were saying that, you know, how some couples, when they're about to get married, they go meet their minister, they go meet their pastor, and they have, like, the couples counseling. Well, we were talking about that if you're thinking about getting married, you should play a two-headed giant game, and if you two can get along and coordinate, then you two are ready for marriage. But if your two-headed giant falls apart, you might want to work on some things. And even then, you'll see the couple that works really well together and, you know, they're independent and they play well. But then you have the couple that starts to fall apart in front of you where, you know, the woman will go to attack and the man will be like, I wasn't ready. And she'll be like, you're never ready.
God.
And then he'll be like, why do you keep emasculating me? And she's like, why do you keep? And then they just fall apart in front of you. And those are the couples where you're like, I think we've got this one.
Yeah. Couples are interesting to me, but my experience with couples who play is very frequently people who play have very different play styles, even though they may love the same game. So I'm less interested in how they play together and more interested in when they are not in sync, how they treat each other. I have actually had a couple bring up their sex lives when arguing about a Magic game.
And see, I find that fascinating. I would just be like, tell me more.
Not this year. When I can distance it away from the ethnography entirely, I will write about it with no names and nobody having any idea that it happened. Yeah. Mm-hmm. They'll forget. I'm sure they'll forget. But yeah, like literal, you can't do this either kind of stuff. And that's like freaky. Like, why are you bringing that to a game? Do you guys need a minute?
Yeah. Can we get a time extension, please? They had to go air out some grievances.
Yeah, but so. I can see that person sitting at the other person going, that's not the only thing you need an extension for. Done.
Terrible. So how is the ethnography going? How has it been? Because you announced that you were doing it on my show.
Yes.
And that was a little while ago. I think that was before
it
Gen
was,
Con.
It was actually before that. I started, your show went up in June, right before I actually went out into the field. So
And how's
the
it going?
Idea behind it was, and is still, we're still in that same 3 years. If anyone anywhere who is a part of the Magic community invites me and I am physically and economically capable of doing it, I will go and I will be an ethnographer on your couch and I will cook for you. And apparently what I will also do is sort your card collection for you. According to your instructions, although we can talk about that in a minute because I do have a limit. It's not a numeric limit. And when I did the announcement with you, I said, and I will, if you have small children, I'll help you take care of your children. And the thing that I learned from that is now instead of I will help you take care of your children, I will help you keep your children alive. Because one of the fascinating things about ethnographic work is no matter how open-minded you think you are, very much like Burning Man, ethnography will teach you what your own limitations are. And I did not realize that I had calcified some very Northeastern United States methods of parenting. So I was not, I wasn't somebody who was able to change my whole personality enough to meet, you know, 'cause like when you have a kid of your own, some things very much like playing magic, some things become shortcut and automated and your kids understand you, you and your children, you and your own children have negotiated that space like a team. These are other people's, and as an ethnographer especially, you don't actually impose your own ideas on that at all. You do exactly.
Because isn't the whole point supposed to be, like, you're supposed to kind of act like you're not there? No, like, just they're supposed to go about their lives?
That's the myth of objectivity that's actually a problem in most of the sciences, where you believe that you can extract things and that an outside observer is somehow or another superior to personal experience. The trick with anthropology is more to identify subjective experience and then use it as part of a quantification. So you admit right off that it's subjective. So you can't pretend that I'm not on your couch because that's silly. There's a whole ethnographer on your couch. And I ain't that small. And I do change the environment by being in it. That's another thing that we learned. Heather made no secret of the fact that I was with her. So we can talk about that because it's all over the internet. But when I was out there, she was able to take me to places that were important to her with gaming. And then there's always that balance of, well, I'm still a participant. I'm a native participant observer. How do I continue to do magic the way that I did magic? And I play pre-releases and, you know, and it's still my budget and I'm not going to miss a thing of magic because I happen to be studying magic. That's really silly, right? So she took me to this fantastic store, Action Comics, right outside of Nevada, and everybody, and it was absolutely as wonderful as she said, and I really enjoyed playing the pre-releases there, and because I was talking to people there, and I was staying with her, she actually met more people in her community because of that. So I am that part of the ethnography. Can I embody a path of knowledge? Can I actually embody how the game is shared? That part was really successful. If you think of me as physically the game, when I'm on your couch, I'm the same as in effect having the game in your game closet, right? Now you can play magic whenever there is an ethnographer on your couch to play with, or you can share the game with other people. I have an ethnographer on my couch for 2 days. Let's have a party so everybody can come meet the ethnographer, tell the ethnographer stories, and play magic. So people would tell me stories and then they go off and play magic at one or two of the sites. And at first I was like, is this really what I'm supposed to be doing? Can I do short trips and long trips? And I kept trying to like make it narrow, but I'm wrong actually to make it narrow. If people want to invite me into their house to be the excuse to have the party to get all of their friends together to play magic, I am now willing to be that too. So I guess I could be a pinata. I'm not just an ethnographer on your couch. I'm your ethnographic pinata. You can have a party around it.
Olay.
So the other thing that was really cool, and I will be, now that I'm on winter break, following up with how to strategically do it, is I got some invitations in Europe and Copenhagen, and there's an area in Romania I'm actually very interested in trying to get to that I know about. People are awesome and wonderful. I got invited. So when I was out in the field, I stayed in one place for 2 months, and that was amazing because I really got to see how people interact with their collections when they're not playing. Like I could actually be somewhere and people wouldn't play for 2 weeks, and they don't think of how much they're interacting with Magic and other games at the time. But because I was there, and because it's really just sort of like maybe having a relative as a house guest, because I pitch in, I'll help clean, or I definitely cook. I am beginning to develop an idea that for every time you want to play Magic, you're probably spending 2 to 3 hours involved with your collection for every time you go play. And that's untracked time, but that's time you're interacting with your cards, maintaining your collection if you're the kind of person who maintains it on your own, or navigating the mess that your collection makes if you're not maintaining it,
Sure.
just dealing with card flow in the house. One of the things I found out is that WotC did actually do an ethnographic study at one point of this really interesting, very specific question, which is, the cards closest to your bed apparently are your oldest cards. And that as you move through the house.
I'm actually looking at my bed right now, and that's really hard to determine for me because I have piles. Like I have a windowsill, and I have at least 5 or 6 piles on my windowsill that don't necessarily fit that
Yeah, and
theory.
see, the thing is that I actually have cards like right next to my bed. And it's true right now, but it wasn't true when the person who did the study told me about it.
Okay.
It wasn't true because I was playing standard and I sort my cards and build my decks in my bed. I make my bed, I keep everything really, really flat. It's the largest flat surface for me to spread out cards. So I, at that point, had the most recent cards by my bed for 2 years. But I finally got rid of this television that was in my armoire, big thing this year. And so my entire collection is organized inside this armoire now. So the cards closest to my bed are now the old legacy cards. So that ended up being true, where it wasn't before. So where that's a kind of marketing ethnography, like you want to know about card storage and card usage, you can get a lot of information, but it's very, very short. Like you only have to go in and drop in somebody's house and kind of look around or talk to them a little bit. The kind of work that I was doing that was really long term and living with you, basically. It's a lot like real world. Like, yeah, because
Yeah.
like your first week that you've got me, you're introducing me to the things that are important to you. You're getting used to me if you don't know me ahead of time or you only know me a little. And then the week after that is like when we start setting up the routine. And then like after that, it's when you stop worrying about the cameras or the ethnographer, and you just are. And I really hope that I can find some other spots that are willing to have me that long. So much valuable information, especially about the people who don't play OP, was really made aware. Like, if you have small children, whichever parent is involved, like your babysitting has a lot to do with like, can you actually complete a game? One of the interesting things is who is it that gets interrupted more by children when you're playing a game at your kitchen table? And it changes who it is. It's not
You mean between
between
mom or
mom or
dad?
dad or even like sisters or brothers, like who is the person most likely to be interrupted at the table? Because if you think about that, all right, so here's where that would matter, right? We're going to go with stereotyping right now, based on small child. So it's like a 3-year-old child. 3-year-old child is mom-centric because mom's away at work. Okay, so we'll break up the stereotype a little bit. Dad's the one who's home more during the day. Mom's away at work. He's had dad all day. And he doesn't need dad anymore today. And so when mom comes home and they're just playing like, their casual after dinner game to just unwind, he's pestering mom. more because she wasn't there. And that means every time she stops to talk to the 3-year-old, totally loving, but every time she's doing that, her eyes are away from the cards. She's not concentrating on the game so much because she's concentrating. So if you think about how focused we have to be when we play, being a parent gaming can give you the impression that you're not a good player because you're not doing as well as the person across the table from you who's not being interrupted. You're not thinking about your gameplay in relation to toddler. Toddler is interference. And also, especially if it's a pleasant interaction, you're not even really thinking of it as an interruption, right? If dad has toddler in his lap, even if toddler is behaving, that's just like a different, like toddlers are squiggly, right? So there's an interesting thing there where how do people who are interacting with other people while they're playing, which is not a thing that generally happens in competition, right? What's their self-image of their play style? Do they actually really know what they're capable of? Do they say that they're casual gamers? Do they say that they're competitive gamers? So those are kinds of questions that came up in the field just from me observing. I got to observe like 5 families. So nothing is very specific to any one group that I've just been talking about. So yeah, that's all stuff that affects your game, right? And that matters when we start talking about who's an OP and why are they an OP. And it matters about GPs too. One of the really cool things that happened was finding out like dads would go together as like little weekend trips together to go to the GP. And they would be possibly qualified as quantified as casual gamers. But so many parents of young children, that's such a big part of magic.
So it sounds like your ethnography has been a success so far since I last talked to
Yeah, it
you. Would
has.
you
And then I
agree?
came back, and then I had to do it very, very differently because I'm located in the Philadelphia area, if anybody is interested in getting in touch with me that way. And now I started focusing more on events and what happens when I play myself. The continuing saga of Adrienne can't get a gaming group together to play Magic on her own time continues. But what are the barriers to my doing it? I started, since I'm doing it ethnographically, I got to look at it more like, what are the barriers to other people who say they want to play with me and also can't get to me? And it ends up, some of those barriers are literally the same barriers as to why women at Bryn Mawr make dates on like with significant others and have to break the dates and how difficult it is to do any kind of sustained social contact in our school system because of the way our school assigns things and the kind of demands our school makes on our time. Other schools have successfully managed to have magic communities. Ours has magic players, and we never connect in a useful way for us. Girls who live in the dorms can play and probably do play together, but finding each other or centralizing is actually a real challenge on our campus.
Well, and is that something you think you might be able to solve, like from your work?
Well, it would be the kind of thing I'd be able to identify. So what it will happen is I will write up a report for my final. It was 76 pages on season
Oof.
from September until December. So if you want to ask me questions about that, I got answers.
We might save that one for another show.
So
I'll have Frank Carson on that show, and he can discuss his thesis, and you can just have a
yeah.
thesis off. It'll
I
be
don't have a
wonderful.
thesis. I'm still doing it's still ground research. But what I would be able to do is go, if there is no central location and dorm living students do not go to participate in organized play, these are the things that if you don't have them, it will be difficult to sustain an organized group. That would be the kind of thing I'd do. Like I'd be able to look at an area and say, this has these barriers for establishing this kind of group, but this kind of play may be more successful. Like, some places play EDH because EDH is just more successful to maintain. Yeah, some places.
So speaking of maintaining an organized play, there was a big announcement that came out this year that Wizards was basically changing the structure of blocks and how they release cards. So the way it is right now is you have a block of three sets, and then there's three sets, and then there's a core set, and then they repeat the cycle. They announced that each block will now only be consisting of two sets, and then there will be no more core sets.
But they did say that there's going to be another beginner's product that's going to be launched. So I'm
Okay.
actually super curious about that because everybody ignored it. So everybody focused on the block structure, and people got really upset because like angels are only continuously released in core sets. So people were worried we've had two sets with no angels.
Well, when you say people, I think you mean
No,
Heather.
actually, I can honestly tell you people.
Oh,
Heather
people.
is just the loudest cheerleader. Here are things I know. Dragons, goblins, and angels.
People love
People
them.
love them, especially outside of organized play,
Oh,
especially
yeah.
outside of OP. So
I remember that back when M13 was a thing, and there was oh God, there was the Archangel. She was exalted. I can't think of her name, but she was the one where and then all your creatures had
Oh,
exalted.
Sublime Archangel.
Right. And that was a card that really didn't see a lot of standard play, but I could never figure out why it was still so
And that's
expensive. Like, I'd go to my
because
local.
it kicks ass in Commander.
Well, even that, I remember just looking in the card case and asking the owner of the store, why is she $15? Why is she $20? And he said the same thing you did. He said, people love their
People love
angels. They
angels,
love their
so and
angels.
shiny angels. I'm still not 100% about the foils, but being in the Las Vegas area apparently gives you like an injection of I like shiny things. So I kind of appreciate foils a little bit more now that I've been to Vegas for so long. So it's very exciting to me that we're going to go to these two block storytelling things. They also got rid of the novelizations because you know what?
Well, the Theros one was so badly received,
The
though.
well, and that was weird too, right? Because it was three releases, but they only released two books. Jenna Helland had written them, and she should write all the things because I will be unpopular for saying this, but I really don't like Elspeth as written.
Oh,
I
yeah.
very frequently feel that the archetype and art are the parts that we emotionally attach to, and that it's a little bit like being a DC Comics fan, right? Like you end up loving the character, but you can't pay too much attention to the canon behind the character, especially if it's a female character that you love that embodies for you positive value, because their idea of things that complicate the character are also frequently things that make our female characters very problematic to an audience. So it is no secret that I frequently refer to Elspeth as Little Tortured Annie. But Jenna Helland made me care about her and made me accept her as a person. And then the stupidest plot I ever saw, where all of a sudden she's healing and she sacrifices herself for this guy that she might have shtupped once. And sort of looks a little like questionable about consent since he was possessed by Xenagos. Like, that's not questionable. That's just me being charitable because I really like Jenna Harland. But like that's the idea that finally Elspeth gets laid and then she's going to go give up her life that she's only just sort of gotten back for this
And
guy.
from what I understand, he wasn't even that warm towards her either. Like, it wasn't like it was this instant, passionate thing. Like, from what I understand, he was sort of
Do you know what it's
standoffish,
like? It's
maybe
like,
even.
did you watch Cheers?
Not
Okay,
really.
I'm trying to think of a show that we've both watched that, or like how I'm, oh, you know what? It's actually almost exactly like How I Met Your Mother, where they did,
I haven't watched that
yeah,
show
but
either.
you know the storyline part of it. I didn't watch it either, but we all know
I
because of
don't.
just like everybody blasting about it all over the internet. They do 11 years where you think it's about these two people. And then And then they inject the actual person in for the last season in order to get to a plot point. I will not spoil the end, but it felt like that. Like we got Daxus in as this romantic interest, even as a romantic interest was weird. And he gets inserted into this into Elspeth's storyline. Theros gets inserted into Elspeth's storyline in this kind of standalone thing. And this is the part where I wonder if they've actually thought of like game narrative and game theory from video games as maybe something to touch a little bit more when we're building the Vorthosian side. There have been a number of flavor fails where like the flavor and the card play don't match. And that's one of the things I'm really hoping with moving down to this two thing. Part of it is if you keep trying to have a show in three acts through the cards, and then you're trying to supplement it with these written tools that have a lot of constraints. So let's talk about why Jenna might have gotten stuck that way. All of a sudden, we're producing two books instead of three books. She might have had to squelch down plot that would have made things much more interesting. There's an assumption that readers will fill in the blanks, so the use of trope is not by itself bad. But if you think you're doing something new, but you don't spend time establishing it, it's only new in your head. The viewer, the reader will only get to see the trope. Jenna navigates these constraints, which are basically right for hires, with incredible grace, and massive talent. And not everybody survives those constraints of writing so well. So I'm kind of excited. I like the graphic novels, even though I'm not personally that into them. I like them better as a way to explore because it's such a visual media. But I think the two blocks are going to be good because you can actually like just run the story and you don't have to worry about this rise and fall of three acts, which I think also is a problem with card play, right? Like you have this small set or this medium set in the middle, and then the third set always comes out, and the third set's competing with spoilers for the fall season, and it's whatever the big hot casual thing is coming out, and changes to OP, and you release so much product in the summer that something's going to get overwhelmed. I think Dragon's Maze got completely overshadowed by Modern Masters.
Oh, yeah.
Because nostalgia players and competitive players were so excited about it. Who cared about Dragon's Maze by that point? Conspiracy, by the way, sold really, really well. But
Oh,
competitive
yeah.
players don't know that. So competitive players, I've heard competitive players say, oh, well, Conspiracy was such a bust, they're never going to do that again. And then somebody goes on the internet and talks about how wonderful Conspiracy was, and they're very, very disconnected to it. So the player base, even though we're very connected by Twitter and things like that, I think there's still a real break in experience. I'm kind of hoping that the Vorthos design play breaks are aided by the two block structure. That's my big hope, actually.
Yeah, I'm curious about what it means for competitive play, of course, because I was a very big standard fan for a long time. I didn't play any other formats, and the last standard season actually drove me away from standard. I was tired of Pack Rat. I was tired of Cloudfin Raptor. I was tired of just the same two or three decks. Burn was a thing which I
Yeah.
don't like.
You're never going to like Burnhunt.
I'm never going to. But I just wasn't proud of any of the win conditions. So I went over to Modern. Love Modern. Modern is now my favorite format by far. And Standard has gotten better. Like I do enjoy playing Standard now. It's not my go-to anymore. Like I've invested a lot of money in Modern, which makes it I can't really turn back now. But Standard's not painful anymore, and it is nice seeing different decks be good. Like Yggdrasil Reanimator will be the top deck 1 week, and then a week later it'll be Mardu, and then you're really not seeing one dominant deck, which is what the format
I think
needed.
the Khan's game design had a lot to do with that. Like this is a really I almost never play multiple colors in limited, and the mana fixing is so good, even I play three colors. Last night I played three colors and splashed for a fourth, because Butcher of the Horde, man.
Yeah, you do that for
Yeah, you
Butcher of the
totally do
Horde.
that for Butcher of the Horde. Or as I like to call Mardu, Kalia's recruiting grounds.
It's so strange to be seeing the power level of Khan's cards because, like I said, I've been playing Modern and Siege Rhino. Siege Rhino is the reason why Junk has managed to survive, the Delver decks and other decks like that. Siege Rhino, like what? Like it's still there's still this part of me where when I see standard cards, I kind of immediately want to snipe somebody. Like there's a part of me that wants to be like, this is Modern, right? This isn't standard. And now it's like you've got Treasure Cruise making an impact. You've got
You
Siege
mean
Rhino making an
Ancestral
impact.
Recall the Renewed?
Even Anaphenza has been popping up in lists, and just seeing these card Murderous Cut has been appearing in Modern. That really says something about a set when you can see its impact in all formats, where it's like these cards are not just staying in standard, they're so good that everybody wants a piece of them, and that's
Do
huge.
you think that the All right, so if we look at the year, we started out with Theros, and Theros basically, by design, literally moved us back down to narrower mana bases. Because I do actually think if we had gone from Ravnica with all the mana forever and never talked about the guilds, and then we went into, say, cons, where now all of a sudden we just had like different ridiculous mana, I probably would have thrown up my hands. My meta is like this Abzan kind of thing, Abzan mid-range, and I gotta tell you, it just feels like Jund with different colors. Like it feels like that
It is.
game over and over again.
It is.
And that's just my local game story. That's not the world of Magic, but it is the kind of thing that makes me go, do I really want to be playing standard against Jund, which I was already tired of, if I had not had Theros in the middle of that? Like, so that's kind of interesting. So we winnowed down to like the idea that single colors are good, and then one of the things that really overrode Journey to Nyx was the reality that fetch lands were coming back, right? So now people are forward looking. But I feel very much like cons in design ended this year in this really, really positive way. It's got such strong structure for limited, and the standard is very open. Nobody's playing one thing. People are still experimenting. Abzan's just good because people really just love to play multiple colors, as far as I can tell, and like games.
Well, it's also a safe choice. The Jund strategy is a very tried and true strategy where you're one for one answers, you drop a haymaker, and you
Right.
win. That's something I think a lot of people can get behind. You have something like Sultai Reanimator, which can be inconsistent, let's be
Yeah.
honest. And some people don't know how to delve. They don't know how to mulch. That's very foreign to them. You have the Mardu strategy, which is a lot of one ones, and some people don't know what to do. Going back to psychographics and why people
Right.
play certain decks. The concept of Jund is very comfortable, and it's a traditional deck, and it's just old school, and people feel
And it feels
comfortable
like
playing
spell
it.
casting. I cast my spell, you stop your spell, we exchange things, and then I win. Yeah, so that follows like the mythic Magic story. Yeah, so, but I think that the design of cons is really good, and I'm going to be very curious because it's our last free full set. And it's designed around drafting differently with the packs, and it's designed around telling a story.
And the story sounds like it's going to be interesting. I know I was reading Mark Rosewater's column from Monday, and he was talking about the formula for this block. And then he said the first set was going to be Planeswalker comes to a world. This is what the Planeswalker finds. So this is the world as we know it right now. And then he said the second set was going to be Planeswalker goes back in time to fix world or whatever problem is going on with the world, and that's what he finds when he gets there. So now we're seeing like the devolution of certain mechanics. We're seeing the previous clan leaders, not like we know them today. And then they said that set three was going to be the Planeswalker did what they were going to do in time. Now they've come back, and this is what the world is like after that. So it'll be very interesting to
It'll be
see.
interesting if it will be like a mending style thing where it really, hopefully not where it shakes up the rule set, but more like maybe where I wouldn't mind seeing something that actually freed up creative in some sort of way. I do think having to anchor to the brand's idea of who their lead characters are, which is increased with the movie, which was, I guess, the other big news of 2014, right? That the movie deal is a real deal. But it's still in development, so everybody can like make sure that they keep breathing. Holding your breath right now is a terrible idea. Yeah,
Don't fuck it
well,
up.
or
Don't fuck it up.
or like die a noble death rather than I know I got into a lot of conversations about, oh, it's not going to be really funded, this, that, or the other thing, or a lot of people were kind of like knocking on Hasbro not wanting to support. And I'm sitting there going, Battleship, which is what people kept talking about as a failure, actually made three times its investment. It costs $100 million. If you put that in Battleship and you want to create a fantasy franchise like Lord of the Rings, which was basically the pitch for the studio who got it, and you've got Game of Thrones, so you also can like see how to do story. And one of the writers right now that's currently attached to it is a Game of Thrones writer. I think assuming that it's going to be lowballed, or assuming it's going to be like one of those Dungeons and Dragons movies from the 90s when fantasy did not have respect, and Gen X wasn't the people in charge of the money. I think that's a mistake. I think that the better answer is, if it's almost but not quite what you want, how are you going to feel about it? What happens if all of the complaints that many people I know have about the Planeswalkers, what if they make the characters better than you can do with a card? Like, let's face it, Jace is a little whiny bitch. Jace in Mark Rosewater's daily cartoon is so much better than Jace that's actually developed by Creative.
Are you talking about the
Yeah, like I love
figurines?
the thing that he's
I
doing with
love
the
them
Funko
so
guys
much.
now, with
Yes.
that's like real world too, right? Real world Planeswalkers.
Did you see
Yeah, did
Kiora
you see
when
Kiara
Kiora was introduced?
get her thing on
She
the
was
pool?
so no nonsense. Like, this is how it's going
Yeah,
to go down, and I'm
let's
going to take
face
your
it, you
pool.
can't afford not to rent to me because Nicol Bolas is your landlord. Like, if nobody does
Is
anything
so
else, they should
genius.
just go through Mark Rosewater's feed, Tales from the Pit, where the Funko figures are. I think that's some of his best work in creative in a very long time. I look forward to it. Like, sometimes he makes a joke and I cringe, but like, Chibi Jace, how do you not love Chibi Jace? So my headcanon is Chibi Jace is real, and all of these other Jaces that we get to see on the cards are just men trying to project what they want onto Jace. But Chibi Jace is the real thing.
I'll allow
And
it.
Nissa, how cool is Nissa in the apartment?
It's funny though. I feel like, so whenever I love the Nyssa and Liliana dynamic because do you know Allie Medwin who works for R&D?
Yes.
Okay. Allie and I are very good friends. We're both trans gals, and whenever I see Nyssa and Liliana, I always imagine that it's me and Allie. So like there's a specific one where Nyssa and Liliana clearly don't get along, and and Nyssa tries to keep the peace and Nyssa tries to be very diplomatic. And one of the comics has Nyssa going, "Look, I know we don't get along, but let's find something we have in common." And Nyssa goes, "We both have tattoos. My tattoos come from my elvish heritage and the bonding of my people." And Liliana goes, "Mine comes from a thousand year old pact to live forever by bleeding dream and demons dry or something." And then Liliana goes, "I've made you uncomfortable, haven't I?" And that's very much me and Allison, where Allison's very much the noble, yes sir, very, very follows the rules. I like to call her two shoes. And I'm the one that's like, "Fuck it, let's do this." And Allie and I, whenever I see those comics, I'm like, "That's you and I." And there was also one with Nyssa and Liliana where Nyssa wanted Lily to recycle. And she was like, "Look, I know we don't get
Lily
along,
is
but we
all
have to live
about
together."
recycling.
That's what she said, though. So Nyssa says this thing, "I'd really like it if you could recycle." And Liliana goes, "I do
She
recycle."
does. She's right.
And that was very much me and Allie. Or it was like if Allie and I were living together, I could see her being the one that was like, "Could you please keep it down, please? We have to do this. This is the rules." And I'm very much the one who doesn't care about them. And that just reminds me of our
But
friendship,
you
and I
do
love
care
those.
about some rules. You know
I do,
why?
yeah.
Because you kicked total ass at the Community Cup on the flip. And you kicked ass by playing hard.
Man,
You want
man.
to
The
tell me a
Community
little
Cup
bit
was.
about like putting that deck together?
Well, I mean, I want to talk about the Community Cup in general because, in terms of big events for the year, that was one of the biggest. I mean, that was a big reminder of just sort of where I am in the community, where, I've always. For the last 2 years, I don't know my numbers. I don't know my subscribers. I don't know my downloads. I still believe that people don't know who I am. I still don't know why people would want to meet me. I don't assume anybody knows who I am. And being picked for the Community Cup was like, oh shit. And people know who you are, and people were cheering for you. And that was a big wake-up call where it's like, maybe my show's not so little
Your show
anymore.
hasn't been, there's a reason I asked you if you would help me launch. Like I needed to actually reach the community. It's no good if I'm not reaching the community.
Yeah. So it was great being chosen. And the one thing that I want to keep saying over and over again was that it was a 100% positive experience. I went into it being a little hesitant about meeting certain people. I wasn't sure how certain people and I would get along. And I didn't do so well in a lot of the events. Outside of the Iron Root Chef, I didn't do very well. And I was concerned that it was going to be, why did you do that? How could you do this? What were you thinking? And it was never like that. It was 100%, okay, you've got this. We're going to pick ourselves up. We're going to do this. There was never any
So
drama.
you
There was never.
carried the team on the Iron Chef.
I did. But like I said, the point I want to stress is that it was so awesome, and we really did form these bonds with each other. And I'm also really proud of the fact that our team was so diverse. I think we were probably the most diverse team I'd ever seen. We had a teenager who also had a disability. We had it also happened to be a woman. We had myself, who was a woman and a queer woman at that. We had podcasters, bloggers, streamers, fathers, single guys,
But
casuals,
do you know how awful it
Americans,
was for me that
foreigners.
you were playing against Helene? Who am I supposed to? Oh, and Aaron. These are two of my favorite people.
I know. And it was such an amazing experience just being able to. I was just happy to be there. I mean, just being able to lose to Aaron
Yeah.
Forsythe. I mean, that who can say they even get to do that?
I
So.
don't think I'd actually have the nerve to play against Aaron. I mean, well, certainly not right now, God knows. But
Yeah.
yeah.
But yeah, it was an amazing experience, and it really lit a fire under me to want to be better. Realizing that I was representing the community, it was like, you've really got to represent the community. You've really got to be stand up. You can't be flipping tables anymore. You can't be, you are the community now, and you are a face of the community. And I just realized that I don't want to lose that. I got a Christmas card from Hélène Bergio
I
this year.
know.
I don't want to lose that. I don't want to throw that away because I had a bitch fit at a tournament. Like, it just doesn't seem like a price I
Well,
want to
you've been
pay.
fighting Tilt for a long time. You actually had a New Year's resolution about Tilt this year. Do you remember?
I said I was going to be nicer to my players.
Look how
But I
low
just
that bar
realized,
was. See, you've already hit it.
But I just realized, like I said, that I just don't want to lose what I have. I don't want to lose people coming up to me at events and saying, I was at GP Chicago in 2014, and there was a woman named Julie, and Julie listens to the show, and Julie follows me, and she took my hand because I ended up being I got paired next to her. We were sitting at tables, and she took my hand and she said, "I love your show, and I love you." And I'm just like, "What do you say to that? How do you?" I don't want to lose that. I don't want to screw that up. Like, I don't want people to be ashamed of me or to feel bad for supporting me. Like, I don't want to lose all of that love. And if I have to clean up my act to do that, I'm going to have to do that.
So,
So.
that's actually a thing that I've noticed, certainly since I've come back to the game. But now I've had to like notice professionally, which is different than just noticing, which is I have not really enjoyed coverage for Magic. There's a couple of reasons. One of the biggest reasons, actually, is I can't read the cards on my computer, which is how I usually do it. When I was staying with one field site, everybody was going to be out of the house that day, but they knew that I was probably going to end up watching the Summer Pro Tour, and they hooked it up to their much more giant than ever imagine having TV, which was HD, and it was a computer feed. And oh my gosh, first of all, Rich Hagen and its suits,
Are you a fan? You a
of
fan?
the suits, absolutely. I like the way the coverage team has really changed up. They're finding a balance between backgrounding information now, which makes it easier for newer players. One of the things that I was invited to cover as an ethnographer was I got to actually be embedded with a coverage team at Eternal Weekend, and very eye-opening in a lot of ways. It's a place I'm more familiar with because I have a tech background and a theater background, so it was a space I was very comfortable in. But like seeing how much physical space they have to maneuver in, or how many challenges they have for location, you know, I haven't done it with like a big WOTC event yet because you know, like ideally someday I'd love to watch how world coverage works in comparison to Eternal Weekend coverage, which was still independent and on Twitch. European coverage is apparently very interesting too. But I started when I started that thing all the way back in the first little pre-release that was like the beginning of Really Yes Not, the thing I had noticed was facial hair. The player's facial hair had changed in that location from the fall set to the February set. And so then because I noticed it so extremely, I was like, I wonder if there's like fashion trends that happen in the gamers, not necessarily because of Magic, but remember Magic's part of the wider world. How much of the wider world affects our perception of the people that we play with? So I started kind of like really keeping track of facial hair. Which brings me to the thing that I noticed most. The guys in the booth are really upping their game to be professional. For several years now, the pros, not everybody can be Reed Duke, but the pros are actually recognizing that if you're going to be a celebrity, even though there's very little context or training for them to be celebrities, so that's a thing that's very real. Like, nobody says, hey, you won this PT and now people are going to come up to you and ask you for your autograph, or, you know, maybe you're associated with white cards, so they're going to ask you to sign the card that you're famous for top decking somewhere forever, right? So it's not like when you're an actor and you're like, well, maybe some, even if you don't want to be famous, you still have at the back of your head, well, maybe someday I will be famous and it means this. Magic doesn't have that. So it's a lot of the, it's all of the positives and all of the negatives with no support of fame, right? And not enough money to necessarily make all of those things worth it. But this thing that you're talking about I don't want to lose that, it's not, you earned it. You and they and the coverage teams and the pros all earn it by being people that created that response in the first place. You maintain it by recognizing who you are in the community, and then you choose professionalism. You're not choosing a personality change. You're not accepting, air quotes went up for that. Anthropologists use air quotes a lot. air quote accepting, end quote. You're not accepting responsibility. What you're doing is recognizing that the respect you've already earned requires maintenance. So that's a reciprocal relationship. What's interesting is not everybody recognizes, or probably nobody, unless you're an anthropologist sitting on a couch somewhere, and people probably don't recognize how reciprocal it is. So the people who are standing in line for RK Post, for instance, some of them are not recognizing necessarily in either direction. I am giving something to RK Post, or RK Post is giving something to me, and we together are a symbiotic relationship that is a continuous circle of reciprocal cultural exchange. Some people are going to get on that line, and all they're going to care about is RK Post is going to increase the value of my card. That's still a reciprocal exchange. That card has value because RK Post did it. RK Post's signature is important to the value of that card, and you recognize it and you're willing to stand online. So that's still reciprocal. It's just not as warm, right? And then there's like, I don't actually care about any of this, and I'm going to be like one of those eBay signature autograph hounds, and I'm just going to get all of the signatures and I'm going to give them like a stack of cards and that sort of, and that's entitled. And that's different because they don't care about the artist. They don't care about the game. They don't care about the cards. They only care about the profit. That's still reciprocal, but now it's unbalanced. So I think Magic in general is starting to recognize that its economy is, and all of the economies, the social economy and the physical economy and the monetary economy, are all based on this kind of interactive reciprocal exchange. That's what makes it such a cool culture. And
Yeah.
You don't have to, you're not going to lose us by not being perfect, but you're gonna, but I think your choice is really more about being a mature partner in the relationship. The magic community is your significant other, and you realize that to make your significant other happy, you can't actually yell at burn players anymore.
Yeah, that's very true. So speaking of yelling at players, another polarizing topic, cheaters.
Oh, yeah.
This was the year of cheating. Trevor Humphreys was discovered, thanks to some detectives on Reddit, as performing shuffling tricks, I believe, in order to get an advantage, which then led to the discovery of Rookie of the Year Jared Vetter. And he ultimately had that title taken away from him, and it was passed on to Ray Perez Jr., who Brainstorm Brewery loves to pieces and supports a lot. And then there was Marcio Cavallo at Worlds. There was an incident that he was allegedly keeping a card under his playmat, which
that
he
was really surprising, because you know everybody was worried that they were going to throw out the whole team, but the teams don't pick each other.
Correct.
So when you say we're disqualifying this guy for this thing and we're not disqualifying the rest of your team members, that means an actual investigation meant, no, you're the jerk on your team, and we're actually going to make sure that nobody else is punished because you're the jerk. Like, of all of the cheating scandals, that's the one where I just look at it and go, dude. How much did you independently screw up that you couldn't even manage to deflect or share any of the blame?
There was also talk of some shady behavior on Jeremy Dazzani's part, where he was allegedly telling, or he was possibly, I think, working with a vendor to discover what the pros were buying and use that to determine what they might be playing. But bottom line, this was a year where people were up to some shady shit, and they got called out for it, and the community felt very strongly about it. And then there was talk about what punishment was fair. Should there be lifetime bans? Is 3 years enough? 4 years enough? 6 months enough? What did you think about all of this?
So I was at Eternal Weekend right the same weekend that like everything blew up with the cheating right before it. So it was definitely on people's minds. There's a couple of things. One is, you know, because coverage is getting better and because it stays forever, the internet is forever. It is exactly the opposite of transient. Mm-hmm. People can look at like old wins. People can gather information. I think people need to start thinking about competitive magic as more like baseball. It's going to end up being a stats-based game. We talk about a lot of things, and I haven't actually stopped working on the idea of magic as an extension of sports and coaching philosophy. So one of the things that I know is it's much more like golf. Or figure skating, where it's individual performance and lots of statistics go back and forth, and how you put the statistics together matter. But now we've got video. So one thing is kind of weird about, if you're going around to vendors and asking about what pros are buying, what if that information was public, right? How does that change the game? I'm not necessarily sure secret tech is like investigative reporting of secret tech. It's not like stealing the other team's playbook. You know what I mean? Because it's not that formalized. I would be willing to entertain arguments that that's just creative problem solving. Not necessarily noble, but certainly creative problem solving. Other stuff bothers me though. Like, if you're good enough to get like to mid-level grinder regularly day doing on your own and you've plateaued, because you have to be at least that good for the cheats to matter, right? Mm-hmm. How much time do you have to put in for a good shuffle cheat to actually be able to stand up on film? So one of two things is going to happen. You are not going to put in as much time as a good Las Vegas shuffle cheater. Mm-hmm. Or you're just like, That might actually be time that if you just spent it a little bit more on the game or broke up your thinking about the game, you wouldn't have gone down that road. money's involved, ego's involved, the people involved are either very young or very tied up in identity for, you know, like, well, it goes back to, like, you didn't want to lose that feeling. They don't necessarily want to lose the winning feeling. Other things feel weird or sketchy, and so you feel like you're not doing anything anybody else isn't doing.
But do you think there's also an attitude that the and I'm not saying that this makes it right necessarily, but do you think that it's also something that the community does by putting so much emphasis on the person who came in first versus, you know, like there are people who will, and I've had them on my show, you know, they will go to their first pro tour, they will finish 23rd, and they will say, I sucked.
Yeah.
And I will be like, number one, you got to the pro tour. Like, that's pretty awesome right there. And number two, 23rd at your first pro tour
is phenomenal.
But to everybody else in the community, if it's not one, if it's not three even, you're nobody. You're nothing. It didn't matter. That's nice, bitch. Get back on the train and do better. You know, that's an attitude that we have where...
And it's a very Western culture attitude because participants in sports know, hey, I went up three rankings this year in gymnastics. I really hit my personal goal. And when local coverage is covering those kinds of sports, golf, gymnastics, tennis even, but American media concentrates on these top things, a lot of the mythology of competition, which is one of the things that does need to be broken apart, certainly creates the value. But another part that's really important is how much we use, it goes back to EV, and you know how I feel about it, but you know, if the way that we justify playing a game to the outside world is that we can make money, then we start looking at the greater world. Who's making money in the greater world? Well, honest dealers are not the people who are on television on the top. It's a big problem. It's a huge problem. But also little kids who are the biggest cheaters in my local store, like 8 to 12 years old, the game's not real to them. So they don't really, you know, there is a problem, especially when they're sitting against like an older player or a female player where they'll just try to like end run. And you want to be nice about calling them out on it to some extent or another. But, you know, like our store has ways of handling it. And they're not universal, and I wouldn't even suggest it. But I am noticing if you are kind of like impulsively trying to cheat for an extra edge because you're not taking the game seriously 8 to 12, then you kind of get used to it maybe by the time you're 15 to 18. And I do think it's significant that, like, some people really screw up in their early years. And they're fine by the time they're 22. But if they got like super famous when they were 18, and then the worst thing that we know about them later is that they cheated at this point, how do you come back from that? Mm-hmm. And there's ways to do it. But the thing that I keep thinking of is Alex Bertoncini. Thank you. I never get his last name right, which is probably better and keeps me safe from libel. But... So I remember I had just come back to the game and actually like the whole, he could have cheated until the cows came home. The way people went after him made me go, why would I want to be part of this community? He was very, very young. There were legal issues with had he actually cheated at the event that he won at, and they removed that. And I'm like, I didn't know how I felt about that as a grown up and that sort of thing. But the thing is that like, he probably had people about 50-50 or people like me who were sort of like, he may have done this other thing, but wow, this other stuff is bad. And the way that you recover is either admit that you did it, move forward and be nice. Don't admit that you did it, move forward and be nice anyway. Or you do what Alex did. Mm-hmm. Which is basically go, I'm not going to actually admit it. It becomes more and more obvious, however, everybody defending me is a really nice guy. None of his subsequent actions were that person. That actually made the cheating allegations much more obvious. Also, once you've been caught cheating, don't you think you want to do the cleanest play possible? If you don't think you can play clean on camera... Even if it's just because you're tired, right? Like, we all make stupid, sloppy mistakes when we're tired. But if you're the person who got the 18-month ban before, perhaps you just go, I'm gonna drop now. You know what I mean? So there is a part of me that's sort of like, there's a level at which you sort of wonder what's going on. It ends up that once I looked up the guy who got taken out of Worlds, everybody had been speaking about him as a not up front guy in the beginning. And if he had been banned, his team never would have had to deal with whatever level of disruption that was. And they, by the way, went on to play fabulously without him. They did not come in first, but they didn't not make the next round either. So that's a kind of thing, like that's a really important story, right? Lee Shaitan playing was a really important story, coming in off of protesting for freedom.
I want to go back to cheaters for a second because there's also talk of how harshly they should be dealt with. And I am of the opinion that I believe cheaters can be rehabilitated. Or I and it's interesting seeing people have the attitude of once is too much, you're cut off.
That's never realistic because it's way too easy to witch hunt. Like everybody thinks they're Sherlock when they're looking at the videotape.
Oh, yeah.
And sometimes they are Sherlock when they're working at the videotape. But you know what? I'm a kind of three strikes you're out girl for just about everything. And I'm sort of like, once could be misinterpretation or happenstance. Twice could be because people are looking to get you. Three times you're either guilty or stupid, and you should probably just stop playing the game. So I'm comfortable, but also remember that they've got a linguistics problem with the word cheating. And they did actually like try to release intentional, like you can't say unintentional cheating, right? Like their whole,
That's like saying you're a little
yeah, their
pregnant.
whole belief that their words are completely neutral and that they have come up with the best word possible is a little bit like believing in EV. Like, unless you actually have a formal linguist working with you and an anthropologist telling you how it's received, I promise you these words are not being received the way you think they are. I swear to you. I will go into court and sign an affidavit. These words are not behaving the way you think they are. And cheating is a huge, huge word that is applied very frequently because of the way that it's written into the rules. And most people, you know, we talk a lot about casual gamers, but we should actually maybe talk about casual spectators. Because there's this idea that everybody who bothers to turn into a Twitch chat is a highly invested player. These are engaged personalities. No, they're not. They're eyeballs that maybe care about the game enough or play the game enough or, you know, like that guy and like his podcast or whatever. Which means that, you know, prioritizing the loudest people who've caught things is possibly a gut reaction as opposed to a marketing reaction. You know what I mean? It's not quantifiable. But at the same time, recognizing that there are casual viewers also means that if we're going to use those words, so that it goes both ways, right? Oh my God, he cheated. That person is forever tainted no matter what. When most judges actually know that cheating the way it works in the rules is not for the kind of events that we saw this fall. How do you express that? One kind of cheating is different than another kind of cheating because you put the word intentional or unintentional in front of it. One is a mistake in play. Unintentional cheating is a mistake in play. That is not the same thing as cheating at all. Cheating is intentional. There's no such thing as unintentional cheating. So at least use English properly, damn it. I mean, and I know judges will get on my case because, you know, because they work really, really hard to try to find language. And remember, everything that's ever done in a judge world is done by committee. So we shouldn't be mad at individual judges. And I really, really hope that judges understand how much I love them when I say this. But the words matter when you put them into a document, especially when you put them in a document that creates a public opinion. And
Absolutely.
so the public-facing aspect of the rules, I think, is actually, if you're going to keep promoting this level of coverage, I would like to see us do something like intentional cheating one. The first one is 18 months. The second one is 4 years. If you can manage to come back to the game in 3 years and they're all intentional cheating rulings, then you're banned. Mm-hmm. That seems fair. Also, the reality is it's very, very difficult to, there's no due process that works in real life for challenging a ruling, mm-hmm. right? Like you can contest it, but you're playing a game across a table in a warehouse. Everybody has to remember things. Eyewitness testimony for everything is incredibly unreliable. Unless you've literally got it on video camera, and then we're all putting on our Cormac the mind reader hats and trying to figure out what did everybody intend at that time. And then everybody who's ever made that mistake by accident starts freaking out and like, I'm never going to play an organized play ever. Oh my God, I'm going to die. And even the nicest DQ that happens next to you because of an accident of somebody's play, even the nicest judges, it's really traumatizing because all of a sudden, like, people spend so much money to get to these things.
Oh yeah.
So, you know, all you need is like to not understand a rule. How many times have they changed triggers?
I can remember after the Jared Betcher thing happened, I went to SCG Minneapolis. And to me, that tournament was so tense because it felt like there were much more judges than normal. It felt like, you know, people were almost waiting for their opponents to make a questionable move. Like, everybody was on edge.
Yeah.
And it was just a very weird atmosphere to play in. And I was like, I hope it's not like this always, because that was really unfun for me. I mean, I did have fun at the event, you know, but the first couple hours was just waiting for people to loosen up a little bit, because it was, oh, wait, did you, how many cards are in your hand? Oh, I kept track. There were only four. And like you said, it made people terrified of making a simple mistake or not knowing how something worked. And that's the opposite. Like, people are supposed to feel comfortable going to opens and maybe their first Grand Prix, and we don't want to discourage people from that.
Yeah, and at the same time, there's the flip side, where if you don't actually enforce the cheating rules, there's a sense that you're going to just be taken advantage of. And it's a very, very difficult thing to balance. I'm really actually hoping that as coverage becomes more and more common, even at the smaller events, I would like to believe that what we will start seeing is people realizing if they're going to make it to day two, their chances of being in a feature match are X. And if they have, nobody's that good that the camera is not going to catch you unless you're a professional magician. And even if you're a professional magician, you have to know the rules that well to be able to put the right thing in or the right thing up. And all of those things are so, so dependent. So what I'm really actually hoping is that The judges are going through a growth period and a change period this year, exactly the same way the rest of the community is. And we're all, like, this is really only the second year of Planeswalker Points. It's obviously been very successful for expansion. I thought the way they handled announcements this year was awesome. Did you not see lynch mobs after everything? Nobody was nervous about, I mean, there are, every time there's a change, there are people who are going to get caught in the gears of the change. Especially if they're on the cusp of being, you know, almost good enough, right? And it feels arbitrary, but it's a 20-year-old game with a continuously changing and stabilizing organized play. I personally feel like we're heading towards a more mature, responsive, and by mature I mean stabilized and aged. I don't mean like old people play. Not old people like me don't play. But like, you know, like a market maturation. The organized play is starting to mature in such a way that it recognizes it's responsible for the environment. It's not trying to ditch its legal liability through a bunch of hoops that actually then leave the gameplay experience exclusively up to local environments, that they're trying to standardize it. You can't actually have, like, can you imagine if everybody played football according to like their own flavor of refereeing? And that's a little bit the way TOs have to do things right now. It's like, you're so dependent on this volunteer leveling up, the game's expanding, we need so many more judges. How do you handle that exponential growth? It's good problems to have, but they're definitely problems. So I don't know. I think I don't disagree with any of the actions that were taken this fall with the cheaters. Mm-hmm. Or even if there is one guy who's actually following the deny you did it and continue to be nice problem. Like he's using that, and if he means it and it's true, then hopefully the system is such that when he comes back, he'll be able to prove it, and he'll be 4 years older, and he'll be a different person. You know, and that's really the thing is, like, if you get a 2 year break and you come back and you're the same jerk doing the same thing, it's not going to be a huge surprise if you get suspended again. If you can manage to come back after 6 years and be the same jerk that you were when the first one happened, you know, we don't need you.
Yeah.
but you should at least, like, there's always the possibility of a false positive, right? And I think we do need a punitive system that allows the fact that crowd wisdom is not always true, or mistakes just happen.
Yeah. So the last thing I want to talk about, speaking of false positives, MTGO has continued to be a very polarizing topic. I personally have tried really hard not to get involved in the debate because I feel like there are things at work that I don't fully understand, and I'm not educated enough to speak on them. I know that you have an extensive background in the corporate world and technology and things like that. So what's your take on this? Like, you know, is Hasbro just not caring? Is WotC not caring? You know, what do you think people aren't quite
seeing?
Well,
Hasbro can't care. WotC is a subsidiary of Hasbro. So that creates a couple of interesting things if you're looking at it at the corporate level. As a subsidiary, mm-hmm. WotC never has to report anything independently. And Hasbro can say whatever it chooses to release. So, like, we used to have numbers that were released, and then they aren't releasing numbers anymore. And those are Hasbro-style choices. I'm pretty sure that things like the movie that are so complicated with licensing are probably more joint division between Hasbro and WotC, because Hasbro actually owns the licenses and WotC is a subsidiary. But mm-hmm. Hasbro's management style with its subsidiaries is that everything is actually run by the subsidiary and it's run in its own. They're given target numbers and budgets and they've got like some level of corporate support. But most of that is WotC. So who WotC is, whether WotC decides to bring it in-house or hire a third party, or like Hasbro can't come in and write the specs for WotC mm-hmm. and say, hire this guy. And even if Hasbro could do it, Hasbro wouldn't do it. Hasbro leaves WotC to its own and to make its numbers. And when they do joint productions, like the Black Planeswalker cards, or when Hasbro came in and said, we would like to have a thing to release at Comic-Con, and then you make it so. And maybe WotC might not have wanted to do that, but said, hey, all right, fine, we're going to do this. And so that's the kind of thing. The Nerf thing would have been like a combined thing.
Okay.
So MTGO is not. MTGO is not like Hasbro has another subsidiary that's making MTGO. It's all WotC. So that's okay. The first part. The next part is, what is WotC trying to, you know, they're still using the same database. I think that there might have been a database change this year. Whenever you're dealing with a legacy system and you're trying to upgrade it but keep the old parts, you're going to have problems. It's just a bad idea in general. If it were me, and understand, I have none of the specs and I don't play MTGO because I rage quit every time I go into the interface. So if you're really going to ask me, I've got problems with it before I've opened up the program. and they probably won't pay me enough for me to come in and do anything professionally about that because I'm really expensive. But here's your first thing. If you're going to, and I thought they did this, I wasn't keeping up with it, but I thought the beta was supposed to be this, where they were basically building a parallel system and that they were testing the parallel system and that theoretically when the parallel system was ready, you'd be able to port information over, or you will have repopulated by hand the information, although I realize it's like a stupid amount of information and maybe you can't. Depends on how broken the old system is. Like, I don't know what that old database looks like, but I know that they've been using the same one since it launched. And if they haven't changed it, if they haven't done a parallel development, you're building like archaeological layers of code over everything. And how do you hire for that? And who are the stakeholders and who gets to have the loudest voice? Like, do game designers have the loudest voice? Because WotC is a lot of things, but they're not a video game shop. So some of the problems are specifically video game design problems, which is one of the reasons like Hearthstone is doing really, really well. But Hearthstone is also a streamlined game.
Yeah.
Okay. So I actually came back to Magic because I was working on an object-oriented precedence and hierarchy chart because I wanted to build a tutorial for Magic. So I recognize how complex it is. I have a four-page precedence and hierarchy list. I actually just did it as a bullet point list, not a chart. It's immense. But that said, every time I hear it at MTGO, I sort of feel like I'm working with one of those pharmaceutical companies where, oh, wow, training is really expensive and it's a drain on our resources. So we're going to outsource the training and we're going to have them build all the multimedia training to train the pharma reps. And then 5 years go by and things are still kind of janky because of the way they give the data out. And they're like, oh, man, this is so expensive. We can do this better in-house and we can use less people. So we're going to go bring it in-house. And every 5 years, training in pharma goes in and out of house for pharmaceutical companies. They think it's like fashion or they have reasons, but I can promise you that there's actually ebbs and flows. MTGO feels like that. It feels like there is still some sort of process for building the thing gap that allows this to, and they still have to actually meet the needs of the people who are out playing it. Like it will cost them money to shut it down for a year and a half if it doesn't work, right? So they keep putting out like something that's almost good enough, but it also, I think not doing parallel development or not investing separately in a parallel system that can somehow or another port is a problem. They did really well with Duels of the Planeswalkers, but that was completely outsourced to a video game company that designed apps, and that's why that plays well.
But what is it going to take, though? I mean, like, there are so many documented instances, and LSV recently had gone through his own on live stream. Thousands of people saw it. You know, Kibler has complained. I mean, what is it going to take? Like, this is just bad. I don't care who
you
are.
This is bad PR. So that goes back to the thing we were talking about coverage before, right? Like, or being a pro, or what does a maturing environment look like? For this game, MTGO, I've been having a lot of trouble with it because in the ethnographic study, people who play MTGO are people who are playing because there's no other way or nobody close to them or no place safe. Remember, safety is a big issue for a lot of people to play Magic, and they want to play Magic. So they're stuck on MTGO because of isolation or location or whatever. Those people are just playing it because it's the game. Other people are playing it really actually more as like a batting cage. This is how I practice for FNM. This is how I test out a deck idea. This is how I investigate a new thing. And the real problem that they have is that they made it integrated into the real money events. So one of two things has to happen. Either get your act together or stop making them money events. Stop making them feed into OP. Keep them as a separate OP. Nobody has a good, you know, so we were talking about how disturbing it is to be DQ'd. How disturbing is what happened to LSV? When Ponder doesn't work, it's not like it's not a key card for like three formats. You know, you've got a problem. There are so many variables. It is so difficult to test. Somebody should have spent a lot of time writing a QA script that specifically tests pretty much every, you know, you should actually have like pre-made game scripts where you know exactly what's being played and make the computer run it through at computer time. Like, I don't know what their QA is. I don't, you know, they may not be giving the teams enough time. If they're trying to tie in these releases to the game releases, God only knows what their bug iteration and fix lists look. I mean, like, I feel terrible for the people who actually have to do this because you can tell that they're working really, really hard. The game is this complex. That's not the limiting factor. The fact that you keep using legacy code to implement the game is probably the factor. That would be my guess anyway. But or just not having a lot of it might be like who's got power? Does the PM lean towards game design or lean towards implementation, or what happens with international rollout? What's their server plan? Like, are some of these hiccups how fast it's receiving information? We don't know. We have no way of knowing. We can make some guesses. But if you can't tell, you got to get it out of the OP. You got to get it out of the OP. Don't shut down MTGO. Leave it for what it's being used for, which is a way to play and a way to test. And if you need to have a version that is MTGO only with a strong return policy, basically, when a bug's reported, just have it, it's got to be something better than it's got to be something better than what they're doing now, which is my understanding is you get your ticket returned and you get another game or something like that. So if you're going to have MTGO champions, I mean, you played it for Community Cup. How is that?
Well, from what I understand, I mean, it was very smooth for us, but from what I was told, that was because we had really good computers. Uh-huh. when I said that, because I had a very positive experience. Like I said, I have nothing bad to say about it. I don't use MTGO enough where I personally have not experienced any of the issues. That's not to say that they're not happening, but my experience has been positive. I've never experienced graveyard bugs. I've had to restart a couple of times, but I've also not participated in any of the larger events like PTQs or anything. But when I tell people that it worked fine for me when I was in Seattle, the first thing people will say to me is, you had Alienware laptops that were, you know, the top specs. Mm-hmm. Of course it was going to work for you. Which I find very interesting.
I don't think that the game actually crunches that hard, that you need Alienware to run it. Like, I can't imagine the programming.
Well, there have
that
been
would
a number of
a high level graphics, super speedy connection.
It is common knowledge that it does soak up a lot of memory. I've heard a number of streamers complain about that fact, that they've actually watched their memory usage increase the longer
That's
they play it.
That is a programming issue, and somebody hardcore on the programming team needs to get on top of that. Are people reporting memory leaks?
I assume so. I know they're certainly complaining about it on social
media. Which is not the same thing as reporting a bug. So if I can say anything to anybody, if you're
So let's extend the issue. So let's say they are reporting it. Is anyone listening?
Well, that's a better question.
Is there anybody on the other end of the line?
I mean, MTGO is not, I haven't been able to study it because it's so dysfunctional in the field that, as of the moment, nobody who plays exclusively on MTGO has invited me to stay with them.
And I was just about to say that, like, it'd be very interesting for you to stay with somebody who does play through MTGO the most or predominantly. I'd be interested to see what your experience would
be. And it will, I mean, in that particular case, it will be much more me keeping that person company because I am very bad with computer games. and like I said, the interface just drives me absolutely insane. I have some issues with DOTP, but not nearly as many as I do with, because one feels like playing the game and the other one feels like playing a computer game about the game. They don't feel like the same thing. And there's a huge difference between being able to have a card in your hand and the person across from you. So, like, there's all sorts of soft signals that we get that way. I would love to be invited someplace where somebody is primarily on MTGO, because I imagine that their interaction with the game, I mean, and also honestly, it would probably let me really see the game. I'm making a lot of suppositions based on, and this is important, I can have all of these suppositions based on watching the reaction every time they have bugs. Like, I don't play on MTGO. Everything I know about MTGO is through WotC itself and people reacting after they've used WotC. That in and of itself is a problem. I think it's the coverage problem. You have to be aware. You have to be aware that people are watching and that's creating the impression. But there's nothing about moving cards around and having card interactions happen that indicate that your personal computer should be having a memory leak, to my understanding of programming at this particular point in time. I've done budget tools that have memory leaks. They're always a programming error. Like, we're tracking mathematic transactions that add up, roll into other things, and decides who wins and who loses money. It's the same programming. It's just one has cards, the other has like credit cards and cash. So I would be, if I were the PM and I were hearing this for the first time, I would be like really curious as to whether or not I could reproduce the memory effect. And I would get off the Alienware computers to do it. Like, there should be, you should actually really be testing for something like MTGO at the lowest, flat out, I've got this half dead computer because I'm in community college testing zone. Because that's important. Also, like, how old is it? Like, do you have to have a certain browser and above, or is it still playing on old browsers?
I'm not sure. Like I said, I don't play it often enough. So
yeah, because I mean, some of the problems might be sometimes if you make stuff really backwards compatible, that can cause hiccups for people with newer stuff sometimes. You know what I mean? Like if you need to be on IE6 because you have like one client that's using IE6 and all of this important information comes from them and you're all using, you know, the latest Google Chrome, it may only work well on Google Chrome and not work well on IE6. Or sometimes if it works well on IE6, it won't work on Google Chrome. So some of these issues can be browser issues too. Like it's not optimized for multiple browsers.
Well, I have certainly enjoyed going down memory lane with you this past year, and I hope that our 2015 is enjoyable and is fruitful. And if anybody wants to volunteer to have you come stay with them or just wants to get in touch with you, how can they find you? How can they
get a hold of you? The best way to get in touch with me for anything Magic the Gathering related is on Twitter, which is @DreamtimeDren. I have a website, which is mtganthropology.com for the ethnography itself. Anthropology is easier to spell than ethnography. And I'll put up an email, which is drinne@me.com. Tried to keep it as simple as possible and yet still tripped over it. And Stocking Tiger and I can be at your house because Stocking Tiger will always be my holiday card.
And I did extend an invitation for you to come to my place as well.
And I was thinking that I was going to actually travel on winter break, and then I realized what my house looks like when I'm traveling all year. So I'm going to take winter break so I can go to other people's houses and know mine's okay. But I'll start traveling again for the ethnography in June. So I'll be traveling again in the summer for people who would like to invite me. And I am going probably to the MTG cruise. I think that's going to be my big field work for this next quarter.
Okay. Well, thank you so much for coming back on the show.
Always love you.
If anybody's enjoyed what they've heard here on the Deck Tees, you can always find the show first and foremost on GatheringMagic.com. The show is available on iTunes and Stitcher Radio. Please subscribe and leave me a review and some stars. You can follow the show on Twitter @TheDeckTees. You can follow me on Twitter @OriginalEstrus. And you can email the show @TheDeckTees@gmail.com. Thank you all so much for listening, and please take care of yourselves, okay? Bye!